Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Does anyone know this restaurant in Lincoln Park that's been open for the last year until just recently? Dinner and a Movie?
Yeah, I saw what's going on there, and I have never heard of it.
So before. This the Dinner and a Movie has been shut down by the city after a 14-month battle. And the proprietor of Dinner and a Movie, this guy named Rashad Bailey, is pretty outspoken about what transpired. I thought his comments were sort of interesting. I have mixed emotions about them, but much of what he said rings true to me. He said in an interview with CWB Chicago, For a moment, I felt like crying. I mean, I made it to Lincoln Park. We took all these pictures of customers having a good time. It was so nice. I'm going to change my number because people are still calling for reservations. You've got regular black people who come to Dinner and Movie. They're like normal people. Then you got those other MFers. They're savages. All it takes is one or two, and it's like, damn, blank happened. I'm black, so I can say this. At this point, whatever.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
The problems began about a month after he opened the restaurant, 2500 North Ashland. That's May of last year. There were shots fired. A large fight erupted outside the doors. No one was struck by gunfire, but police ordered the business to close immediately under the city's summary closure ordinance. And the deleterious impact ordinance, public nuisance ordinance, has been something that's been plaguing him, as has Alderman Wagaspak, to tell his story. Anyway, so that happened last May. He reopened after meeting with city officials, neighbors, plan of action drawn up, blah, blah, blah. But now he's done. One of his chief complaints, in addition to, you know, I don't want to gloss over that comment that I just referenced of his, which is
he said it.
Normal black people come in, not a problem. Then there are the savages. One or two blank heads come in and they ruin it for everybody. Right. Which is what we've said on this show, and then not particular to race, but what we've said on this show for years, as long as I've been on the show, which is it's a small fraction of the population. The police basically know who most of them are, or at least the pipelines through which they come. And we pretend we're paralyzed to do anything about it. And it's not true. It's a choice that the political leadership of the city is making. One of Bailey's other complaints is that black-owned businesses are treated differently in Chicago. Reference the murder of that rapper FGB Duck in the Gold Coast.
Oh, yeah. During broad daylight. That was scary on Oak Street there.
Bailey said he was in an effing store on Oak Street and they shot his ass up. Is that the store's problem? No. If it's a black customer at a white store, it's a shooting. If it's a black customer at a black store, it's a problem. Shootings by those bars on Hubbard Street with white and Arab owners, ? That's not a problem, he said. I'm a little suspicious anytime somebody goes for the race card, but I think this is more complicated than just raising the race card. I think he has a point. I think he has a point here. And by the way, if you go down Hubbard Street, like between State and LaSalle, on a Friday or Saturday night, It's a ghetto. And there have been problems at Hubbard Street bars and restaurants. And, you know, his I haven't really thought
his
about it.
His place is right by the Clybourne corridor where it starts.
And I didn't really think about it in the terms that he puts it. It's a black customer at a white store. It's a shooting. It's a black customer at a black store. It's a problem. Should he be held to account for, you know, those one or two blankheads that show up and ruin it for everybody? I mean, you know, you got to provide security. You got to provide a safe place of business. We understand this.
It costs money to do that, though.
Yeah. But there are limitations to what you can do as well. Obviously, these smash and grabs that have gone up and down Michigan Avenue, despite security systems, despite security guards. So nothing is safe, is fail safe. But he goes on, does Mr. Bailey. We've got a mayor that leads Chicago that's not from Chicago. It's true. She's from Ohio.
And we have a superintendent whose heart is in Texas. I don't care what anybody says.
We got a mayor that leads in Chicago that's not from Chicago. So don't pull that black card on me. Mayor Lightfoot knows nothing about other walks of life, the crazy savages. And when I say savages, I mean the crazy black people who put pressure on regular black people. These are his words. Wow. These are the same people spreading blank around Chicago. They don't like those crazy MFers. It's like you have a good time, you go home. Them, the only thing they effing respect is being put in handcuffs. I'm 6'3", 200 pounds, and this blank is crazy. As a city, we're effed. The music they're listening to, how'd we go from everybody loves bump and grind to effing killing each other? How'd that happen? We got problems in Chicago. Yeah, nice throwback there to like...
That is so true. That is, he nailed that.
Who am I thinking of? Like a Johnny Gill era? Yeah. Bump and grind. We got problems in Chicago. This ain't no effing Mayberry. People getting shot and robbed all throughout the city. People getting their cars stolen. People losing their life. Whatever leaders are doing, it's not working. Then you got a person leading a police department who's not even from Chicago. He doesn't even speak the effing language. You got some politicians that are so far to the effing left that they pretend we don't have problems in our community, even after looting stuff. That's a problem. I don't share that same ideal, that same way of thinking. They want to call it urban stuff. Man, F that. It's effing savages. Bad people should be in jail. That's the thing. So when they walk up to you, you're like, how the F are you out here? Lock all their asses up. I don't know what's going on with our DA or our state's attorney. I don't know what the F they're called because I don't go to jail, but it's a problem. Wow. That's some high octane. And I love it. Absolutely love it. Appreciate it. I don't know exactly what happened with his restaurant in Lincoln Park, and I've talked to some friends who are business owners in Lincoln Park. Those are mixed opinions about whether it was really a club that he said was a restaurant or it just looked like a club, but it was really a restaurant, whether he's getting jerked around by his alderman in the city or not. I don't know, but his perspective is over the target as far as I'm concerned.
Well, what I heard from my cop friends, they told me that they were called there a lot of times, but... They're like, we're called, you know, a lot of
places. To a lot of places a lot of
A lot of places, yeah. You know, but he's mad. That was his baby. That was his business, and it's gone. And he blames Mayor Lightfoot. He blames the lack of safety, a lack of discipline by people who live in the city. He said the word, Dan. He called them savages.
Well,
and he can say that.
Right, because he's describing their behavior, not their race.
Yeah.
Right. Rashad Bailey went on. He's not done.
Oh, no.
You know why we have a problem in Chicago that's become so aggressive no one can control? It's because when you take the community center away, the streets raise the kids. 2010 is when all of a sudden the park district started renting out the spaces, vouchers, and the parks aren't available. For white people, that's okay. You can drop the kids off daycare and stuff. But black people need the parks, the snack, the summer camp. So when you push the kids out of the community center, you lose the community. They're learning behavior language on the streets. They know what happens on 79th, the rappers, and other bull jive crazy stuff, but there's no effing nets on the rims at Park District basketball courts. The pool's closed. So who's going to raise you? The effing street's going to raise you. And if you're a bad effing child and it's never corrected, what happens? It gets passed along and you become a problem, and now they're erupting because you ignore them for 10 years. We get black people in office. They ignore the black community. You're black first. Take care of yours. The Italian's going to take care of Italians. Yeah, don't ignore them, but take care of yours. He was asked by CBB
if he's going to run for office.
Yeah. And his response was pointed. F Chicago, F this corruption. This is not like a city where if you're a good person with a good heart and a good character and do the right thing, you'll do okay. I feel like we're in the old days. I'm over this stuff. They treat you better in red states anyway if you're a business owner.
Oh.
Wow.
He's woke. He found. He figured it out.
He's awake. He's not woke.
Awake. Right.
And he makes the point, too, colorfully, as was the rest of his commentary. I put my restaurant in a good neighborhood, Lincoln Park, to get away from the effing crazy. Yeah, he goes on and on and on. He's got a lot of pent up frustration, and frankly, I understand it. I don't know. I mean, on balance, I'm inclined to be very sympathetic to what Rashad Bailey has to say about the city, about what happened to his business, about what's happened to the city. Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan, and thanks for taking my call. You know, he mentions in there that the leftists, their things, this Lightfoot and the rest of them in these cities and everything isn't working. It's exactly the opposite. It's working. They want to destroy our society. They've destroyed the justice system and everything and our economy and all that, but they want to crush all these little businesses. They want to, the government, take over of everything. And this poor guy trying to do a business and everything like that. And it, everything is in there like this, where they let the criminals are not punished. They're not held in jail or anything like that. They just keep, and it's purposeful. That's why this goes on with these people. It's unbelievable. When I hear it, I mean, I feel so sorry for this guy. And I realized that he's just one of the victims of a leftist system, the leftist people that get voted in. It's hard to believe that they do get voted in. People need to wake up about it.
Thanks for the call, Craig.
He did recall a situation with other places, and he said a guy jumped out and killed a guy. And then they closed the gas station where the murder happened because the gas station's got to do better. Doesn't that sound like Mayor Lightfoot?
Yes.
You got to do better, got to step up.
Yeah, you're not doing your part. He puts it on police, but he's putting it on the power structure. I mean, I just read that as a catch-all. He says about that, the police put it on the businesses. We can't give everybody tickets. Crime is your business. How about coming up with solutions? There is no solution. The solution is we want your black ass out. It's not everybody, but it's a few of them, and that's enough. And frankly, I don't subscribe to this like institutional racism insinuation that he's making, and he makes, frankly, it's more than an insinuation. He says it explicitly. He says it's institutional racism. But I hear what he's saying about, you know, right. What do you want me to do? I'm trying to operate a profitable business. I'm on the level. I'm running a clean joint.
They won't let him serve lunch.
I opened my business in Lincoln Park because I wanted a safe neighborhood that I figured would have police presence and responsiveness. And as he said, I've been in court 14 months. I was only open 16 months. How is that even possible? And I can't serve lunch, as you just said. So I think his commentary about the city's political leadership, his commentary about the savages versus the normal people of all races in the city, I think that's just spot on. And I appreciate him doing what very few business people in Chicago are willing and able to do, which is to speak out.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
See Dennis Prager at Cigar Night on Thursday, August 18th at the Humidor Cigar Lounge in Lyle. Tickets on sale now at 560theanswer.com/cigar.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We'll get to the Fed's rate hike and what the effort to redefine recession. But first, this idea. Do we need a new third political party? I mean, we have more than two parties with the Green Party and the Libertarian Party. But we need a viable third party option that's comprised of Republicans and Democrats, do we? That's the position of Andrew Yang, Mr. Universal Basic Income. And
where's he living now? What election is he trying to mess with now? Remember he moved to Georgia for a while?
I do remember.
Get those two senators elected.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. This new party called Forward is co-chaired by Yang and former Republican governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman, who won't go away either.
Stop it. Get her a job.
The merger involves the Renew America movement, founded last year by former officials in the Bush administrations, basically, and some from Trump. Some of the Quislings from the Trump years. And the Forward Party, which was founded by Yang, who left the Democrat Socialist Party after he ran for president to become an independent, to try to run in New York City, and then now to do this. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Do you buy the narrative that the two parties have become too extreme? And there's no place in the middle for commonsensical Americans who are solution-oriented, which is essentially the lament of the D.C. establishment, right? They don't want to be with AOC, but they don't want to be with Trump either. And so let's come together, work in a bipartisan fashion, work across party lines, and have a party that truly represents the American people. How do you represent the American people? What's their offer in terms of how they're going to improve lives? The party, which is centrist, has no specific policies yet.
Of course.
Good start.
Just sounds like a good idea. Let me guess, there's a little arrow associated with it. We're moving forward.
Exactly, over the cliff, just like Hillary Clinton's logo. They don't have any policies, but they do have a pithy aphorism. How will we solve the big issues facing America? Question mark. Not left, not right, forward.
See, at first when you said there's a new political party, I thought it was AOC and the Spice Girls, that the progressives are going to start their own party.
They have their own party. It's called the Democrats Party.
Ayo.
Right. Well, that's true. I mean, they've taken over, and that's the argument. They've taken over. That's where the center of gravity is on the left. And then Trump is where the center of gravity is on the right, sort of Trump populism. And that's noxious to establishment Republicans from, you know, the Bush years. And so they want to throw in with Yang and do something at some point about the problems we have. Just not quite yet. Want to reinvigorate a fair and flourishing economy, give Americans more choices in election, more confidence in the government that works, and more say in our future. You know what it sounds like? Yeah. It sounds like big spenders in both parties coming together to do what they've done for, the better part of the last century, which is grow government at the expense of the citizen. These are Republicans. I mean, just talking about the Republican side, because who cares about Andrew Yang? Yeah. And these are Republicans who think government can be a force for good. It just needs to be the right people.
312-642-5600. Excuse me. Turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And when I say force for good, I'm not talking about, the restraints enshrined in the Bill of Rights to provide and protect for people's God-given rights and the expression thereof. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying they think that the government's tinkering with people's lives, managing the economy for us, managing your household for you, directing your kids' education. So I'm not talking about negative restraints. I'm not talking about national security. I'm not talking about the armed services, sort of the public goods, if you will. I'm talking about all of the interventions into the daily economic and civic life of Americans that these individuals otherwise are inclined to celebrate. Oh, by the way,
they have a website.
If this is a new, like this is some sort of new idea. You know, I'm old enough to remember about, 15 years ago when you had the same gaggle of political dilettantes inside the Beltway come together and present us with the No Labels Party.
Oh, that's right.
No labels.
No labels.
We're not Republicans. We're not Democrats. We're Americans. Isn't that wonderful? You know who is prominent in the No Labels Party for all the 5 minutes and for which it lasted?
Who?
Joe Scarborough. That's the kind of former Republican congressman you forget. That's the kind of Republican you're talking about who participates in this masturbatory exercise of a party with the Democrats.
That's right. He had big plans because I remember he was on with us when I was on the station down the dial, and he came on and talked about that, the No Labels Party.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
He was going to be the big head of it. He was ready to go.
We're going to transcend politics. Yeah,
It's what America needs. Okay, that's what he said.
We don't like the partisan politics, the gridlock that is always alleged. It's amazing how much gridlock we allegedly have, and in spite of all that gridlock, we're able to rack up $120 trillion in debt. If you include all the unfunded liabilities, $30 trillion on the balance on the sort of the informal balance sheet, and that's doubled in the last 15 years. All this gridlock. Amazing what we're able to do, gridlocked as we are. Greg, Rogers Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning. Number one, I don't want to party with a bunch of losers. It's kind of like putting together a baseball team with a bunch of players designated for assignment. And if I remember correctly, Christy Todd Women basically ran that state right into the ground with overspending, deficit spending. She was terrible. And I sure as heck don't want a bunch of people that were failures with Trump or Bush or any failures. This guy Yang is a freak, and he's got nothing but trying to control our lives and everything. So I think this party is nothing more than a big government, big tax and spend, maybe not on some of the social issues, but fiscally it'll just ruin our country. So I want no part of it. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
They're going to have a liftoff national convention in the summer of 2023.
Well, I can't wait.
Are they going to have a committee to decide what city's going to get the convention?
Let me predict they will not make it to 2023. Frank, Board of Trade.
Yeah, more jails. The jail party. You don't need a forward party. You just need a jail party.
Yeah, more people in jail. Yeah. All right, thanks for the call, Frank. All right, yeah.
Hey, this website, they have a website, Dan.
Well, of course.
I'm going to forward it to you.
Doesn't it sound wonderful?
It's so nice.
The ugliness of partisan politics, right? Please. Here's why we have a dominant two-party system, too, in case there's any confusion about this, is because when you have intra-party fights, the party accommodates, at least if it wants to be successful, wants to control the levers of power. The party accommodates people who have disagreements on the margins but are coming from more or less the same foundation. And so you can have free traders and, Trump populists in the same party. And in point of fact, you do.
Right.
And to some extent, you could have pro-lifers and pro-choicers in the same party. And you do in the Republican Party. Less so the Democrat Party, but there's still a few left, I suppose. But you can have people that are school choice and people that are teachers union. People that are pro-choice and people that are teachers union flacks in the same party. And you have that in the Democrat Socialist Party. So that's the point is the parties are generally speaking have some diversity of viewpoints on a range of issues. And so once you start accommodating those differences of opinion on the range of issues, then where's the ground that the third party occupies?
Well, this fall they're hitting the road on a national tour, and they want to hear your ideas.
Listening.
Well, they're
tour.
Going state
wonderful,
by state
wonderful.
Party
wonderful.
Registration,
listening to
and
her.
Ballot access. They plan on hitting 15 states this year, and all 50 states within the next 2 years.
Yeah, good luck, Jim in Sheboygan.
Yeah, this reminds me of the rhinos that want to remake themselves after going after Trump for 4 years. I can just see Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger go join this party after their terms end.
Totally.
And,
they're looking for candidates. They're looking for people to run for office right now.
And I remember after Clinton lost, they blamed the Green Party for siphoning off like 2% of their vote. I see this as the Ross Perot of Bush Senior race, where they siphon 5% away from the Republicans in the next presidential election. And I just see it as the rhinos coming up with a scheme to, outdo Trump or maybe DeSantis.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
He's a Democrat, but I think the Green Party is going to be more popular, more well-known than the Forward Party.
Yeah, I'll bet you dollars to donuts that they don't have any candidates that they don't make. There's going to be no interest. You think there's interest because it sounds like something you hear a lot of people say at cocktail parties, or you hear a lot of mindless pundits say on cable news programs, but there's actually no real appetite for it. It's just something people say to sound like they're, sort of above the fray, the ugliness of politics. It turns my stomach because I'm an independent thinker and I'm solution oriented. And most of those independent thinkers turn out, self-styled as they are, turn out to have voted in every Democrat primary since Kennedy. So, it's just posturing. And these people who are part of this are professional posturers. That's what you get. But you know what you don't get? Ideas or work. And if you don't have ideas and you don't put them to work, then you don't have a party. Chuck in Delavan, Wisconsin.
Well, it just so happens I made my own party. I got my name on the ballot for District 1 up here, and it's called the Going Away Party.
The Going Away, where are you going?
Away to Washington. I'm going to Washington, and the guys that are in Washington and holding seats right now are going to jail. That's my party.
So you're really running for Congress?
Yeah, look it up. I'm on the ballot. I don't have to go through no primary. I went got a couple thousand signatures, and I got my name on the ballot. I'm a bona fide candidate.
Congressional candidate.
But you should connect with Frank at the Board of Trade about these people that you want going to jail. But and if you win, where are you going to put your district office?
Probably in downtown Delaware.
There. I just thought maybe you'd have like a soprano style, like a working office at what's the place you're always talking about?
The Abbey or the Bottle Shop.
Bottle Shop, yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, hey, I got to tell you, it's really funny. It's Barman USA, and I have more people from China trying to contact me. That comes in, and it's usually and they send me pictures, and it's Chinese prostitutes. So they're already thinking I'm going to win. So because that's what they all do when they get to Washington, they hang out with the Chinese prostitutes.
All right. Well, don't if you win, be the same Chuck that you've always been. Don't get Swalwelled.
Yeah,
all right. Don't get Swalwelled if you go to D.C. Thanks, Chuck.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, speaking of third parties, Amy.
Yes.
Who said this? I believe in peace, love, equity, LGBTQ rights, abortion rights, animal rights, race mixing, assault weapon ban, sharing the wealth, Green New Deal, Black Lives Matter, prison reform, and good rock and roll.
Oh, boy.
Who said that, do you think?
Bill Clinton?
Interesting. I'll give you another guess.
Okay. Kid Rock?
Kid Rock would say that? Assault weapon ban? And no, I think you're...
That was being funny. Kid Rock, Ted Nugent, no. Joe Biden.
Interesting that you would think that this could have been said by those former presidents. John Hinckley.
Oof.
John Hinckley. So, to, you know, your point and my point for bringing it up, if you didn't know, the rhetoric of a man who spent the last 34 years in a mental institution is indistinguishable from the leading lights of the left. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Join the John Hinckley party. How about that? Well, again, John Hinckley doesn't have to start a third party because his views are already represented by the socialists. You see? See how that works? Speaking of which, I have some unfortunate news to report.
Oh, no. Is this personal?
No. Well, I mean, it's personal in the sense that we were all rooting for him. Leah Thomas will not be the NCAA Woman of the Year.
Really? What happened? Why the change of heart?
Well, it's apparently the NCAA is transphobic. I mean, what else could one conclude? The NCAA announced its conference selections this week. Columbia University fencer Sylvie Binder, who's actually a woman, has been selected to advance to the next round of the Ivy League as the Ivy League conference winner. So Leah Thomas, the dude who swims for the Penn women's team, not going to be Woman of the Year, not even Woman of the Ivy League conference this year. So you have a real problem in the Ivy League with transphobia, because isn't that, if we're not celebrating it, we're not being an ally, we're being transphobic, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm shocked. I'm shocked to learn that the Ivy League, all of those hallowed institutions, are transphobic.
Well, I'm sure. Excuse me. I'm sure she's probably going to sue them for that.
Who?
Pursue litigation.
Oh.
Leah Thomas.
Well, do you have a constitutional right now to be the Women of the Year and the Ivy League or the NCAA?
She'll whip out her record and say, but I've been more successful as a woman in this sport.
Yes, excuse Leah Thomas while she whips that out. I mean, her record.
Yes, thank you.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. The FDA warns puberty blockers may cause brain swelling and vision loss in children. The FDA identified 6 cases in females between the ages of 5 and 12 who are taking puberty blockers, and which presented a plausible association between the puberty blocker and brain swelling. Brain swelling, severe headaches, nausea, double vision, even permanent vision loss, according to the Mayo Clinic. These are the possible side effects of taking puberty blockers that we were told by the number 2 at HHS.
Oh, yeah. Rachel Levine.
No argument among medical professionals that youth access to gender-affirming care such as puberty blockers is valuable and important. No argument? This study would seem to present an argument. unless
it
you're,
doesn't fit their narrative, Dan.
Unless you're unconcerned about 5 to 12-year-old girls suffering from brain swelling, severe headaches, nausea, double vision, or even permanent vision loss.
And Rachel Levine, as you know, she's transitioned.
Which is a segue to this story about Jeanette Cooper, brought to us by the Independent Women's Forum. Jeanette Cooper is a Chicago mom. Her daughter is Sophia. She hasn't seen her daughter, Sophia, in 2.5 years.
My daughter's name is Sophia. She's amazing. On July 22nd, 2019, she went to her dad's house for a regular custodial visit, and she never came back. I later found out that she had told her stepmom and her dad that she was trans and she didn't want to live with me anymore. She felt unsafe. I missed my daughter's 13th birthday, her 14th birthday, and her 15th birthday. She will be 16 in August. People who are imprisoned have more communication with their child than I do. It's been 2.5 years.
And when Child Protective Services stepped in to investigate, something that, as you'll hear from Jeanette Cooper, she cooperated with, she didn't see a problem with, let's have the investigation, here's the outcome.
Usually, Child Protective Services has a definition of what it means to be unsafe, to either be abused or neglected. There was no evidence that I had done anything like that. When they temporarily kept her with her dad for a period, I was fine with that. I thought that's what they should do. That's the responsibility of the court to investigate if a child is saying that they feel unsafe. So they did a 7-month investigation. I had psychological testing, so did my ex-husband, hours and hours of interviews. We each had home visits, and they did interviews with other people who had observed my daughter and me together. After that report came out, I thought, surely this is going to resolve itself. Clearly, there is no finding of abuse or neglect. They didn't find anything about me that is unsafe. But the thing that I clearly am not complying with is this concept that good parenting means that you affirm a child's idea that there is something wrong with them. I'm not willing to do that. They want me to have a certain understanding that there is such a thing as a child who is born transgender and this is who they are. I don't believe that. My child is a girl. I won't lie to her or anyone else. I think that's good parenting.
Is it good parenting? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Oh, my heart breaks for this mom. I mean, I couldn't go a day, let alone years, without seeing your child. And DCFS, I mean, that's Child Protective Services. So I don't know why she's not. If she's in Illinois, that's the thug group that is the worst organization I've ever dealt with in my life. So that's who she's dealing with. She's not dealing with rational people.
No, she's
dealing with inexperienced people who some of them don't even have children.
No. She's dealing with ideologues. She's dealing with political operatives. She's dealing with people who are saying, if you don't affirm your daughter's view, then you are unfit to be her parent. That's what she's dealing with. And so she's prohibited from seeing her daughter except in family therapy.
I'm not going to believe in a lie, and I'm not going to convince my daughter that somehow she is so weak that she cannot hear her birth name. If I say Sophia, she will still live. I promise her that I will sit there with her through her distress. I will be present in her life. I'm not going anywhere.
Sophia is to remain in her dad's custody. Her mom, Jeanette, can only contact Sophia through U.S. mail.
The final agreement that I have signed, yes, I suppose I agreed to it. I'm not sure I had any choice. It had been decided that something was wrong in this child's life, and they needed to solve that problem because she was in distress in some way. And they needed a specific thing that they could change in her life, and I happened to be the chosen one. It is easy to say that mom is a problem and we will eliminate her, and all of a sudden everything will be fine. That's not true. That's not what's happening.
I'm reminded of that picture you tweeted, or that tweet that you retweeted a couple weeks ago, Amy, where it was the girl who had a picture of her as a young girl in a football uniform.
Then she's
young lady now, and she's, you know, positive,
gorgeous.
Yeah, and feminine and so forth. And what was her comment?
She said, thank God my parents didn't, you know, feed into me wanting to be a boy. Something like that. Because mm-hmm. there's a lot of tomboys growing up, and I was a tomboy growing up. I hated wearing dresses. I wanted to, you know, play 500 in the street all the time. I didn't want to do any of the girly stuff. And thank God our parents didn't, you know, feed into our wants. You know, it was just a phase. My mom, I remember her saying to somebody, it's just a phase. She'll grow. It's okay. And nobody gave any attention to it. No one fed into the drama. They just let me do what I wanted to do.
You have one.
There's a lot of girls like that out there.
1 in 5 Gen Zers identifying as trans.
How did that happen?
So now think about that for the parents listening. Think about, and particularly parents who are divorced, think about how easy you could be in the position of Jeanette Cooper or that dad in Texas that had to fight in court for parental rights for his son, and in opposition to the mom who wanted to begin puberty blockers and transitioning for the son.
And now we know today that puberty blockers can blind you, can give you severe headaches, and there's a whole list of things that we just mentioned.
So, Jeanette Cooper, mom, yeah. Not mad at Sophia.
The process by which she was removed, and it was solidified that she would not be in my presence, that I would not have contact with her, is damage to her. It is a trauma to her. In no way should family court separate children from their biological parents without any evidence of abuse or neglect. That is wrong. It shouldn't be happening to me. It shouldn't be happening to any parent. It definitely should not have happened to my child. She is the greatest victim in this entire thing. My daughter did a normal adolescent thing. She tried something, but there were no guardrails. Nothing stopped her. I'm not mad at my daughter. I'm not disappointed in her. I'm disappointed in the adults that have failed to protect her.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I've got to say, I'm pretty impressed with this mom, and you'll be as impressed as I am, I think, most people, when you hear her describe what her job is as a mom. And I don't know the guy. We haven't heard from him. But I don't know what kind of dad can keep a mom away from her daughter.
A monster.
Like this. Or parent in general. It can go in both directions. I don't know what kind of person does that based on political ideology. Listen to Jeanette.
I see that my child is at sea in a boat. She is struggling. She is in kind of tumultuous seas. I know that. I have seen that. And what I have been told is to follow her lead, to follow her in this journey. I am not willing to do that. I don't think that is good parenting. It's my responsibility not to hook my boat to hers. It is my responsibility to be a lighthouse, to be something stable that she can see, some guide that she has that will always be there, that is consistent. I still do that today, even though I have no custody of her. I have no medical decision making, no educational decision making, and no way to communicate with her other than by mail. I don't have her phone number. I know where she lives, but I'm not allowed to go there. I know where she goes to school, and I'm not allowed there either. But this is parenting. What I'm doing, even though I have no real contact with her, I am still a parent. I am still her mother. I am still parenting now.
Mom and dad as a lighthouse for kids. My job is not to hitch my boat to theirs. It's to be a lighthouse for them. I like that imagery. I like that metaphor.
I found that tweet. It says from age 4 to 12, I wore boys' clothes. I played boy sports. I rejected all things girly. When my brother teased me for being a girl, I even said that when I got older, I would cut my boobs off. I was not transgender. I just idolized my brother. Thank God my parents were sane.
Will and Skokie are on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. As a grandfather who is kept away from his granddaughter because I made the mistake of once referring to her mother as mom, even though her mother thinks she's a man, and is still married and so on and so forth, I think this is all going to wash out eventually in the mail, unfortunately. It's going to be a problem for a lot of kids. We're already starting to see physical and emotional issues and people coming out saying the trans is stupid and trans is cruel. But it's just a matter of how long it's going to take for us to overcome the media not publicizing this. It's kind of like with concealed carry stopping crimes. There's a lot of it that happens, but it's never publicized, so people don't think it happens. The same thing with this. There's a lot of kids out there who are getting really physically hurt by all this stuff. Experimental drugs, that's all they are, is experimental. And the surgery itself is very, very painful and stays painful. So we'll see how it goes, and I hope too many kids don't get totally smashed. But the problem also is going to be that DCFS and other government agencies who are supporting this, they're never held liable because governments can't make mistakes. Have a good. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call, Will.
Well, what if she's taking puberty blockers, you know, and gets sick and has brain swelling or loss of vision? I mean, again, we can't say this enough. They've identified 6 cases in females between the ages of 5 and 12 who were taking puberty blockers who had these symptoms.
You know, there's some constitutional issues here, too. There's a good piece in the Journal the other day by an attorney out of Texas about parental authority and the high court, Supreme Court's commentary over the annals of their history, its history, the Supreme Court's, on parents' rights, even though, you know, the phrase parents' rights isn't found in the Constitution. But this, some cases like this could implicate Supreme Court jurisprudence. For example, 1923 case Meyer v. Nebraska, this 1925 case Pierce v. Society of Sisters is actually what I'm citing from, unanimously concluded the constitutional order presupposed a sphere of liberty protecting the relationship between parents and the child, quoting from that opinion, the Pierce opinion. The child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right, coupled with the high duty, to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. Well, that's exactly what Jeanette Cooper is speaking to. Jeff in Wheaton.
Dan and Amy, good morning. You know, I'm a little disappointed in Amy. She's not using your pronouns that you've explained to us, you know, and that's exceedingly handsome and extraordinarily intelligent.
I will also accept my liege in terms of how she referenced
My liege. Yes. Yes. Amy is a recovering Democrat, so I really think we need to start focusing on those. I guess we only accept the science, not when it's our biological DNA, huh? We only accept the science in that case, correct, Dan?
Right. Thanks for the call, Jeff. Yeah. No, this is how we're to describe ourselves upon entering a room or introduction to someone.
Good afternoon. I want to welcome these leaders for coming in to have this very important discussion about some of the most pressing issues of our time. I am Kamala Harris. My pronouns are she and her. I am a woman sitting at the table wearing a blue suit. And
I mean, please stop. Just stop with that nonsense.
She is just...
What is wrong with her?
She is just the gift that keeps on giving. She really is. Thank you, Vice President Harris. The blue suit, you said? You're the woman in the blue suit.
She was talking to a group of kids with disability or a group with disabilities, but describing it, but she didn't need to say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We know who you are. You're Kamala Harris. We got it.
She was talking to the president, I think. Yeah. Ron and Carol Stream.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. You know, my name is Kamala Harris. My pronouns are she, her, and I was born with half a brain. Anyway, I was calling about the parents that, you know, I don't know who said, but the parents being responsible. Well, I was involved in some situation. It had nothing to do with transgenderism, but it had to do with warring parents. And my stepmother had an inordinate amount of influence. And so, I have no idea, none of us do, but maybe it's more her than the father, but we'll see. Maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Have a great day, guys.
There's more to this story.
Thanks for the call, Ron.
There's got to be more to the story.
Well, maybe, but whether it's the undue influence of the stepmom or it's the dad, regardless, it falls on the shoulders of the dad. It falls on the shoulders of the dad.
How does any parent deny their other parent a right to see their child?
It happens.
Every kid needs a mom. Every kid needs a dad.
It happens.
No, I know it happens.
It happens all the time. This is a particularly egregious case because this has anything to do with allegations of abuse, even phony baloney, trumped up allegations of abuse that people use as a cudgel in divorce or custody proceedings.
And a kid can allege anything to get out of the house.
This is clearly. Litmus test for parenting is whether or not you subscribe to trans ideology. And if you don't, you're an unfit parent. Let's just bottom line it. That's what the state is saying. Mm-hmm. And for any parent to participate in that against another parent, well, it turns out they're the bad parent. They're the abusive parent. And say, well, you know, they have differences of opinion on it. Right. And you're a trans ideologue, and so your viewpoint is ratified by the state to the exclusion of a mom or a dad's parental rights? No. No. Not in a free society, not according to Supreme Court jurisprudence, I would argue. Ralph and Rantoul.
Hi, good morning. It's unfortunate it's been allowed to get this far, but especially I think it's important to not call people by their preferred pronouns. You know, even that professor won the case, and he refused to refer to a student that obviously was biologically male as a she or, you know, and
right.
I think especially, you know, just stop, like that disgusting person who swims for a Penn. Stop calling that guy a she. Stop it. You know, if he wants to be called Leah, that's okay. You know, that's a name. He could be called, you know, Barrel of Monkeys if he goes to court and changes his name. Fine, right? But it's impossible to change sex. It's impossible. You can mutilate yourself either surgically or chemically. There are only two sexes. There is man and there is woman. Stop calling that freak a she. It's a he. I think if all of us, wherever we are, refuse to participate in that insanity, we will take it back. All right. But participating, even at that level, encourages these morons to proceed. fight back at every level. And that starts with personal conversations. And if my friends don't like talking to me anymore because I refuse to recognize that freak as a woman, he'll never be a woman. He didn't start off as a woman. He won't end up as a woman. You know, fine. Then I lose a friend or two. But most of my friends don't buy into that nonsense. Right. They don't. It started off as political correctness, referring to singular people as they, all right? I mean, it's the bastardization of the English language. We started by refusing to say, you know, he as, or you know, if you didn't want to sound so formal, you didn't say, well, one will do this or whatever. And it crept in little by little, right?
That's how it always, that's how it works. That's how it works. You're always on a path. You're always on a path. Thanks.
Fight back and start now. Amy, please, for the love of God, stop calling that dude a she, okay? Stop it.
Thanks for
the
call,
Ralph. I think it's too late. I'd love to hear from Liddy.
It's not. Why is it too late? Why is it too late for you to stop calling a he or she? It's never too late. It's never too late to stop participating in a lie. Look at what Jeanette Cooper is willing to do because she's putting the interests of her daughter ahead of her interests as a mom.
And I admire her for that.
Liddy in Munster, Indiana.
Hello.
Hey, Liddy.
Yes. I went to high school guidance counselor for many years. And one of the things that one of the professors told us was that there's a period of time that particularly young teens and teens go through a period of exploration. What has changed through the years is that students often, when they explore, they think that if something happens, then I am. They don't realize, they don't recognize that period of exploration.
Thanks for the call, Liddy. Appreciate that. And I think that's sort of what Jeanette Cooper was getting at as well. That's why she said, I'm not mad at my daughter. I'm not disappointed in my daughter. She's doing a natural coming-of-age thing of exploring, but where are the guardrails? Where's the supervision? I'm not tying my boat to her. I'm providing, you know, I'm serving as the lighthouse. I mean, I can't go back to that metaphor enough times. I think that's perfect.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We talked about this story a little bit earlier this week when the good news came over the wire, courtesy of Ramona Bessinger, that she was going to be back in a classroom in Providence Public Schools, Providence, Rhode Island, after having been sent to a rubber room gulag for the crime of criticizing critical race theory curricula within the school system in which she worked. And she's been a teacher for more than two decades in the Providence Public Schools. Ramona Bessinger joins us now. Ramona, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me this morning.
So I guess, you know, begin at the beginning. What you said that got you exiled and what that exile was like.
Well, when the books and the curriculum were rolled out in 2020, we all noticed something was not right. You know, all our textbooks, all of our regular vetted literature and historical texts were removed, literally removed and thrown into dumpsters. And so immediately I asked my administration what was going on. Nobody seemed to know. Nobody seemed to have any answers. And so I kept probing and that was met with being brought to HR for ridiculous, you know, made up allegations. And, you know, in 23 years, I've never had any sort of disciplinary action against me. And all of a sudden I was sort of focused on and kind of harassed and bullied. You know, I hate to say that it's, but any teacher working in the system who has gone up against a sort of orthodoxy, political orthodoxy, will understand exactly what I'm talking about. And, you know, you have to make a choice early on. You either continue to speak out and fight this sort of Goliath, you know, or you quit and resign. And I think a lot of teachers are just electing to resign or to remain complicit and silent. And I sort of chose to keep sounding the alarm. I simply could not let go of what I was seeing, which was this odd sort of historical narrative that pitted white children against black children and oppressor versus, you know, the whole narrative that we've come to understand as CRT. And so.
What did they, what did they want you to teach, and how did they structure it so you would pit the white kids against the black kids?
So what was happening is that all of our literature, you know, the Harlem Renaissance, all the literature that was standard vetted literature was removed. And what came in its place was were these paperback books that seemed to, you know, tell the story of the United States from the perspective of a slave only. And so, you know, initially I thought, oh, these are kind of interesting books. But then that was all we were tasked with teaching our kids. And so, you know, I said, well, where are our regular textbooks? Where are the regular books? And, you know, what was happening with the kids is that they were reading this story over and over and over again about how terrible American history has been to children of color. And that is true. No one's disputing that there are moments or significant moments in American history that need to be addressed and taught to children, but it's certainly not the only narrative in this country. And so what was happening with the young people in our schools that we were noticing that they're becoming sort of mistrustful of the United States. And in fact, at one point in 2021, you know, the kids were calling certain teachers, myself included, America. So in other words, the kids were starting to sort of distinguish between us and them. And then they're stopping, you know, they weren't standing anymore for the Pledge of Allegiance, which is well within the right of any individual not to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. But this was sort of, you know, the shift that I was seeing. And I think others have seen this sort of anti-American mistrust of American culture and seeing America as the other within, you know, within the framework of living in this nation. So
when you started making noise, I'm sure the teachers union backed you up and said, well, teachers have the right to express their opinions about curriculum and we should have a discussion about this, right?
You would think.
Actually,
that
I wouldn't
that's
think.
What would occur.
I wouldn't think. I was being sarcastic, but yes, go ahead.
Yes, I know. The teachers union is complicit, and we see this at the national level. The teachers union is working with the federal government to advance this from national level on down. So I didn't get any support, although they contractually had to represent me in whatever grievance or whatever, you know, harassment complaint that I had. They really did nothing and continue to do nothing. In fact, the teachers union is advancing a lot of this literature and has books. They had thousands and thousands and thousands of books a year, these pamphlet style, you know, race-based, racialized, highly politicized little books. They're handing them out en masse. So no one's getting any help from the teachers union because the teachers union is in league with whatever federal educational initiative is coming down from the top. So,
right, but how are they harassing you? You'd mentioned the word that they were bullying you. What exactly did they do?
Well, you know, of late being placed, removed from my teaching assignment for no reason, absolutely no reason, and they still haven't articulated that reason. They moved me to another school and literally let me sit there for 9 months in a renovated boiler room that was used as, you know, resource without any teaching assignment, any student, nothing, and no explanation. And so you can imagine the humiliation and day after day of sitting in an environment like colleagues were told, literally, not to speak to me. So there was an attempt probably to sort of see if I would just leave, you know, and under the pressure, many teachers do when they're teaching, because there's stigma attached to this and can be embarrassing and et cetera. So that was the most significant thing that they did to me. But prior to that, there was a lot of, you know, just every single thing I was doing, walking out of a building during a fire drill was suddenly I walked out incorrectly. And so I was brought to HR for that. But, you know, silly things that they know that, you know, wear you down. And certainly in the very beginning, when I started blowing the whistle on the issue, it did wear me down. But, you know, after a while, you gain support. And in my case, I've had the very amazing fortune to have Judicial Watch help me fight this. And Jim Peterson, senior attorney for Judicial Watch, really, I put him with my sort of ability to push through this very, very difficult time, because without their help, I would have probably have been buried in yet another statistic, another teacher who quits, resigns under the pressure.
I mean, it's the juvenile behavior of the adults, and the goonish nature of this too, and what that, the kind of example that sets for the kids is really just a head shaking. But it's also noteworthy that not only did the union not back you when you first raised the issue, even though they're legally required to represent you, as you mentioned, that you had to go outside to outside counsel, to Judicial Watch, even to get proper representation for the grievances you were filing, inconsistent with the collective bargaining agreement, I assume, your treatment. And ultimately, that's how you found success. You had to get outside counsel to take up your case, to go after the school district, because the school district, the teachers union are aligned, and put in the battle that way.
In part, yes. So I did have some representation from the union, but that representation, I feel, was guided by the presence of Judicial Watch and the presence of the, you know, Jim Peterson, who helped every step of the way. So, you know, the union does what they have to contractually,
yeah,
and the degree, yeah, in which they represent teachers is, you know, marginal,
yeah,
at best.
And so you're back in a classroom this fall, and how do you expect that's going to go?
Well, it's going to be interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, we have activists, teachers at Classical High School. In fact, they staged a protest. I was speaking to parents about the curriculum, and the union staged my own, you know, union member staged a protest. So it remains to be seen what they're going to do. My guess is they're going to rally the troops and probably try to get certain students or students to mistrust. And, you know, really this is a terrible game of bullying and harassment that is going on in probably all public institutions, not even just education. And I know a lot of people can relate to that. You go up against these people and they come after you. So it's significant. What I expect is that they're going to continue to try to get me out of the classroom. They don't want me anywhere near the curriculum. Currently, a lot of teachers in the district have been sending me curriculum items that are absolutely frightening and absurd. And we need to really, you know, hopefully I can continue to have access to this, the libraries, the books, the culture and climate, you know, the DOJ information, professional developments that we're mandated to take. There's a lot of stuff that needs to come out and that people need to hear about. So hopefully I can continue to do that.
Yeah. What age group are you teaching this fall?
High school. I've yet to learn. Yes, okay. Exactly. I don't know what age, or whether it's 9th grade, 10th, 11th or 12th. I'm sure they're in a huddle right now as we speak to try to figure out where to place me and what to do.
Has the example you provided, you're talking about the communications you received from other teachers, has the example you provided encouraged others to step forward, be public, be publicly supportive, be publicly questioning of some of the choices being made by administrators and school board members?
Well, unfortunately, teachers are really, it's really not easy. It's hard to explain in this very short clip exactly what happens to people. But, you know, there's a lot of sleepless nights. If you're harassed and, you know, and by administration, it can make your school day very, very stressful. And so I understand, and I'm, you know, a lot of teachers will just choose to quietly, you know, put their head down, shut the classroom door and do their best and hope to get through the day. And unfortunately, this is contributes to, you know, this bureaucratic coup that we're seeing. People really need to stand up. Teachers need to stand up against this very, you know, nefarious political activity that is currently happening in our schools. But But no, I'm going to say that the majority of teachers will remain silent. I mean, look at some of the my colleagues, Tony Kinnett, for example. He has a presence currently at the national level. He has also spoken out, and he was fired. He was on the administration end of things. I'm on the teaching end of things. But this is what happens. This is what they do. They're up. This is no different from what, you know, Hitler did in the Second World War, singled people out who sounded the alarm, had children report on their neighbors and their families. This is no different. But this is what I have to say to every teacher out there. And if you're listening right now, do not be afraid. There is help. You need to speak out. And it's not going to be easy. But the end result will be more frightening and more terrible if they're actually able to turn this country using our kids and the education system. The end result will be that we will not recognize this nation and children. And so this, you know, speak out now, because if you don't, at the on the other side of this world, we're not going to recognize the United States. I know that sounds dramatic, but this is what's coming down, because it's they're taking the country over.
Yeah.
Hope I don't sound too dramatic here.
She is Ramona Bessinger, English teacher for more than two decades in the Providence Public Schools. Classical High School in Providence this fall for Ramona Bessinger. Ramona, thanks for joining us, and good luck at school. Stay in touch.
Yeah, keep us posted.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you, Ramona, and she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The only benefit of this asinine conversation this week about whether or not we're technically in a recession if GDP numbers come in today at a second quarter in a row of negative growth. The only benefit of
a recession.
The only benefit of it is the more you're trying to redefine recession, the more ground you're losing. So I'm talking to the political hacks in the Biden administration, starting with Brian Deese, who knows better, and then moving over to KJP, who knows nothing. This exchange between Peter Ducey and Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House spokesman on the topic.
If we all understand a recession to be two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth in a row, and then you have White House officials come up here to say, no, that's not what a recession is. It's something else. How is that not redefining recession?
Because that's not the definition. That is not the definition.
Brian Deese said in 2008, of course, economists have a technical definition, which is of a recession, which is two consecutive quarters of negative growth.
I can tell
and
you this.
Yesterday he said two negative quarters of GDP growth is not the technical definition of a recession.
It is
what
not.
Changed?
It is not.
Why did he say that? It
is not. I can speak to what he said yesterday in front of all of you, which is the last thing that you just repeated. There are many factors. There are many factors, economic factors and indicators to consider. And I will say that the textbook definition of recession is not two negative quarters of GDP. We have a strong labor market. We have business that's investing. We have consumers that are also very much investing and purchasing. That is incredibly important. We have 3.6 unemployment. You do not see that in a pre-recession, and you do not see that in a recession. So the factors that we are seeing right now, the economic indicators, does not show that we're in recession. And I'll read, since you gave me some quotes, I'll give you some as well. In 2009, the St. Louis Fed said, while the popular definition of recession is two consecutive quarters of negative real gross domestic product GDP growth, the NBER, which we have mentioned many times in this room, does not strictly abide by this designation. Instead, the committee broadly defines a recession as a significant decline in economic activity spreading across the economy lasting more than a few months. NBER has been around since 1920.
KJP is such a child. She doesn't know anything about anything, which is sort of an affliction of government, including many in the Trump administration, frankly, including many in radio, frankly. So, you know, it's just an affliction. It's unfortunate. As Phil Magnus points out he's from the American Institute for Economic Research, the NBER, which they're now invoking as the oracle of recessions, is backward looking. The Great Recession of 2007-2009, for example, had already been underway for a year before the NBER released its determination. Sometimes recessions end by the time the NBER classifies them, and this built-in delay limits the utility of the NBER scorekeeping for real-time policy decisions, which, you know, is when policy decisions have to be made, you know, in real time. But this, as I said, asinine debate belies the reality that Americans are living. A report from Iowa State University. Rural Americans in 2020, rural Americans stood, household income, post-tax income stood at 58 grand. About 82% of rural incomes went towards expenses, leaving a little over 10 grand in discretionary income for savings and unanticipated expenses. By 2022, however, expenses rose by 18.5% overall. Earnings were not able to keep pace, rising only 6%. The net effect cut rural discretionary income by almost 50% between June of 20 and June of 2022. So instead of having 10 grand of discretionary income, that was cut to less than 5,500. Expenses now consume 91% of rural take-home pay. In urban households, less affected, but still affected. The discretionary income in the last 2 years, June of 20 to June of 22, has been cut by 13%. So the cushion went from, 16.5 in 2020 to about 14 today. So still a nicer cushion, but you're still really feeling it in terms of what you can think you can put aside or right. What you can accommodate in terms of unanticipated expenses.
I mean, the average Illinoisan needs a pay raise of $5,920 to keep up with inflation during the past 12 months. That's if you have a family of four.
For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Jim Urio, analyst for Fox Business, proprietor of Brandt's Restaurant in Palatine. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan. And Amy.
So would you like to opine, get in on this asinine conversation definition? I keep referencing?
Sure, sure. This is so funny because the major takeaway from defining a recession, and it's just the clown show, but the takeaway is who's stupid enough to take the bait and argue about it? And apparently I am clearly stupid enough
yes.
to take the bait.
You and KJP.
I've been arguing about it for 2 days with people. It's so silly when all they could say is, yes, the Fed was trying to bring down demand, bring us close to recession. Maybe we'll be technically in recession, but we will point to the fact that all recessions are not created equal, and we still have a strong, robust labor market. If they said that, people wouldn't point fingers at them and say, why are you trying to gaslight us? It makes no sense that they would take this tack on something so minor. The Fed told us they were bringing us close to and possibly into a recession because they were singularly focused on inflation. Inflation, you guys were just talking about, which that CPI data last month, 9.1 read, month before that, 8.6. That is specifically designed, in my opinion, to underestimate inflation. It's been changed over the years to do that. We all know that inflation was much, much higher than that. If you're in the restaurant business, you know that your expenses went up probably about 23% when you talk about food, energy, labor. It's just amazing how much it's gone up. So people are suffering. But the debate is ridiculous. We get this print in a half hour, and the only thing, well, 15 minutes actually, and the only thing good about it is that someone's going to be able to point fingers at one another and say, ha, I was right. So, and yes, I'm going to do that if I'm right.
So what are you expecting in 15 minutes?
I expect it to be a negative GDP print. The Atlanta Fed GDP Now model that estimates it has been saying we've been in negative GDP growth for about the last, I think it's about 6 weeks. And it's a pretty good indicator. It's rarely off by that much. They're saying that the last read on it was a negative 1.6% GDP. And again, it doesn't matter that much as long as it can be a mild recession. I think it could be a mild recession, provided that the government doesn't do anything stupid. One would be to double down on green energy and against fossil fuels. That would be something stupid. And two, which this should not be understated, that they are still talking about giving money to people to deal with inflation. Anyone who's taken 1 week of economics understands that that fuels inflation, and it's completely monumentally stupid to do. But will they do it? Probably. Odds are about 50-50, maybe a little more.
Well, what about $740 billion in spend on energy, health care, and minimum corporate tax? That's the Manchin-Schumer deal. What about adding another $250 billion in technically subsidizing chip makers, but doing a lot more than that? There's another $1 trillion in spend that's on the table.
It's unbelievable. I mean, they think that they're fighting inflation and they're fueling it, and we all know that, and deficit spending, and then they act like raising taxes is going to balance it out because they're going to pull in the same amount as they spend, which is never the case. Raising taxes in an environment like we're in right now is going to do nothing but slow down the economy further and reduce the actual net level of taxes they bring in from this. So it's just more deficit spending, and it's just more deflation of the dollar. And the dollar is weak. People look at the dollar index and say, well, no, it's not. It's rising. Yes, yeah, rising against the yen and the euro, who are doing the exact same things that we're doing. How about we measure the dollar against an apple or measure the dollar against a home? The dollar's weak.
Well, decision by Powell yesterday, as anticipated, 75 basis point interest rate hike. And, some were arguing from a Friedman perspective that it would have been better had the Fed's done, had the Fed done nothing. You have the money supply is collapsing. Velocity's at zero. You got about a 13-month lag, but better to do nothing. And we should, based on this trajectory, this modeling, we should be back at under 3% inflation by this time next year, about a 13-month lag from CPI.
I do think that inflation is coming over. And I'll point out that copper's down 35%, crude was down 20%. The five-year break-evens, which is a market-based prediction of inflation, have gone from 3.5 to 2.6, predicting inflation for the next 5 years. I think we are out of the woods, and things are getting better in inflation. And I think Jerome Powell knows that, and that's why I went 75 yesterday and not 100, which a lot of people in markets were predicting. So that, to me, is interesting. And markets, stock markets, tend to bottom when the Fed pivots from hawkish raising rates to neutral. And to me, it sounded like some of his words yesterday made that moment closer than it seemed like the day before. Of course, we'll know more now in 9 minutes when we see the GDP print.
Yeah, but, do you think there'll ever be talk of interest rate cuts? Not until 2020.
I think there'll be talk of interest rate cuts in quarter one of next year. I think that they will go too high. They might have gone too high already if the economy is collapsing. Remember, several things get rid of inflation. The supply chain healing itself, which we've seen some signs of, but it's very, very small. High prices cure high prices because people change their consumption behavior. The Fed raising rates to destroy demand. All these things have happened. So like Dan said, there's a lag effect. I think inflation's coming down already, and the Fed is probably tightening into it a little too much.
Tightening it? You think it's tightening into it too much right now?
Yeah, I think so. I think they should pivot. I think that by the fall, they will pivot to neutral. And by quarter one next year, they'll be kicking around the idea of lowering interest rates.
What do you think about Powell's comments getting away from future guidance type policy making, just playing the cards closer to the vest and just announcing the decision when there's a decision that's been made?
That was the first thing I 100% agree with him saying in a long, long time. The Fed giving forward guidance beyond a month into the future has been silly. They're not very well at prognosticating what their own movements are going to be. And the market places too much emphasis on it. It says, oh, the Fed's going 75 basis points each of the next 50 meetings in a row. Well, they never are. It should always be data dependent. And it would be different. Being transparent and telling people what you're thinking would be good if you were good at analyzing the data and thinking good thoughts about it. They're not. So what's the point of forward guidance?
Mm. The Wall Street Journal editorial board writes, it's always a mistake to read too much into immediate market moves, such as Wednesday's the bounce back yesterday. But if they're right that the Fed is signaling an early end to tightening, then the danger is that we're watching a false dawn in the anti-inflation fight. How do you react to that?
No, I don't agree with that. I think we are seeing the dawn in the anti-inflation. And I think by the fall, I think the stock market could gain its footing because they won't be as worried about Fed increasing rates.
So you're talking. So if people on the sidelines now should get back in?
I think that there could be one more hard move down. I haven't seen the big capitulation that I wanted to, where I see panic. The VIX is like the fear index, and I'd like to see that at about 45 one time, which would indicate to me that all the weak hands are flushed out. But I think we're getting close to a time.
He is Jim Urio, analyst for Fox Business, proprietor of Brandt's in Palatine. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Busy man. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Always enjoy Best of the Web, James Freeman's column over at the Journal. And he's got another good one the other day. Sharkflation, not Sharknado, Sharkflation. It's such a commentary on the eco-doom movement, such as it is, starting at the White House, but not limited. Last year, NPR's Boston outpost ran a story, shark populations are declining toward point of no return, scientists say. Sharks were going extinct. This year, all the talk is about the increased incidence of shark attacks in New England. Release from Northeastern University. The increased presence of great white sharks off Cape Cod is part of a conservation success story that has grabbed worldwide attention. The local seal population rebounded in the decades following the Marine Animals Protection Act of 1972, and great white sharks soon followed. And now there's the suggestion that an increased incidence of shark attacks is the result of, come on, say it with me, climate change. Yeah. James Freeman asked, is every change in the natural world either a man-made catastrophe or a blessed triumph of politician-made legislation? Beautiful. It's wonderful. An ABC story raised the possibility that global warming was heating up coastal waters and attracting more sharks, resulting in shark attacks off the East Coast. But while they reported that supposition, they also acknowledge there's no data to suggest that climate change is pushing sharks closer to shore, but we're going to suggest it anyway. There's no data to suggest it. We're going to go ahead and suggest it. The shark population, sharks are going extinct last year. Now it's a glorious success story thanks to environmental, you know, arbitrary environmental legislation from 50 years ago.
It's such a great fear factor.
Well, that's right. And this is the quality of all of these associated debates regarding green energy and climate change and everything associated with it, which if you subscribe to the Green New Deal crowd is everything. For more on all this, pleased to be joined by Francis Menton. He is the Manhattan Contrarian. Francis, that's where he blogs, ManhattanContrarian.com. Francis, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Honored to be here.
Yeah, I love simple stories like the shark story that highlight the approach that some people take to not even necessarily complicated public policy, just all public policy.
Yes, I completely agree with you. Did you see my blog post of yesterday that relates to how Connecticut was going to save the planet?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us
how that's going to happen.
So Connecticut was going to save the planet by they passed a brand new Clean Air Act, they called it, just enacted and signed by the governor on July 22, so last week. Of course, there already is a federal Clean Air Act, so what are they really going to do? Well, it turns out the main thing in this Clean Air Act was they're going to buy electric buses. To replace their entire fleet, both school buses and city buses throughout the state. And they bought the first 12 of these electric buses. They had a big event in New Haven on July 22 to celebrate the new act, and they actually had people saying that this was going to save the planet. One of the state senators said that by buying electric buses for Connecticut. So that was their big event. The very next day, on July 23, one of those electric buses blew up in a lithium Battery fire, huge battery fire in the town of Hamden. I have a picture of it on my blog. Very funny. And they pulled all the electric buses from service one day later.
Well, that's what I'll tell you this, though. One issue that people aren't talking about is firefighters, when they go to, you know, electric car fires, they can't pour water on it. They have to use a different substance. And so we've got to change the entire way we do business if we keep going with these EVs.
Yes, this is a gigantic fire in one bus, but it was all by itself in a parking lot, and all they could do with it was let it burn out. But fortunately, it was not near anything else. It was all by itself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Gosh. Yeah. I mean, so that, yeah, right. So there's the silliness of it all. There's the expense of it all. But then there's the real impact. And Joel Kotkin writes about this over at Quillette. The biggest losers from greenflation are predominantly the largely powerless working class and the denizens of developing countries. But even energy rich and historically prosperous countries like Australia face severe price hikes and shortages, as do Canada and the U.S. Economies that have been severely impacted, particularly the ag and manufacturing sectors. In the developing world, where environmentalists have been working to block fossil fuel plants for years, more than 3.5 billion people lack reliable access to electricity. And of course, he notes the instability this is creating, such as most recently seen with the coup in Sri Lanka. But this is a point Bjorn Lomborg and others make as well. Just, you know, the real world impact, particularly for the global citizens of enlightened places like Manhattan, who don't appreciate that 3.5 billion people the world over could really see their lives improved greatly with reliable access to electricity provided by fossil fuel driven energy sources in the short term, at least.
Yeah, Dan, I've written about this a lot. It truly is shocking the extent to which the elites will block in every way reliable electricity for the poor people of the world who don't have it. I mean, to give you some examples, the World Bank will not finance fossil fuel projects, and for a long time hasn't financed fossil fuel projects in third world countries. Many of the major private banks, the big American and European banks like J.P. Morgan or Citibank or whatever, or in Europe, their big banks, will also not finance fossil fuel projects in the third world. Now, ultimately, the third world gets around this. I mean, India and China are not paying any attention to
right.
this. But the African countries don't really have a good way of financing, and they are stuck without reliable power. Big cities in Africa get power an hour or two a day. South Africa is totally, the country of South Africa is totally going backwards on this, and their grid is failing, and their cities are starting to get the power turned off pretty regularly because they're following Western dogma on fossil fuels.
Well, even the Western dogma is being visited upon the West. You know, you have EU countries talking about rationing come the winter.
Another subject I write about a lot, which is who is going to hit the green energy wall first. So they build more and more wind and solar facilities, and the wind and solar facilities don't work all the time. They work about between 25% and 40% of the time, and those are, in the case of wind, completely random. In the case of sun, somewhat random. Right, sun is you have it during the day, but not the night. But some days are overcast, and you get very right. little of it, and that's random. So you don't even know when you're getting it, and you have to back it up with something. But they have not; they haven't paid nearly sufficient attention to how to back it up. I just assume that something will emerge, batteries or something, which have not emerged. So you got to use natural gas. And then they've banned fracking. I mean, right? Germany has banned fracking. Almost all of Europe has banned fracking. UK has banned fracking. New York has banned fracking. So, now, in New York, we can get gas from the state next door. In Germany and UK, where are they going to get it? Russia. Mm-hmm. So they are all driving themselves into a ditch, and it's just a question of who's going to start having the failures first.
So
when it's going to start.
Yeah, so recently we had a heat wave, you know, in majority of America, but also in Europe, and everyone's saying, oh, it's climate change. Everybody associating, you know, sound the alarm. And they're trying to get President Biden to declare a national emergency. If he does do that, what does that even mean? What's that going to change?
Well, you know, excellent question. But what it means is that the Supreme Court just said that the statutes under which the EPA operates don't give them sufficient authority to transform the economy. They need a new statute from Congress. So those, like the Clean Air Act, isn't going to do it for them. So if they want to ban pipelines, or if they want to close coal power plants, or if they want to spend a lot of money on wind turbines and so forth, where are they going to get that authority? Well, so they go through the other statutes, and they find there's a bunch of statutes that give the executive powers if there's a national emergency. Like there's something called the Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act, or FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, has its statutes, and those things are already on the statute books and give the president the power to spend money or to do other things, but ban oil exports, as an example, if there's an emergency. So what's an emergency?
An emergency is a
defined term in the English language. But no, for these purposes, an emergency means whatever the president says it is. So there you go.
I wanted to get to something else in New York that's similar to Chicago. Maybe a little bit more of an emergency than us melting, having 100 million people melt as. This is Biden's climate policy goof said last weekend. And that is, you had the attempted assassination of Lee Zeldin, your Republican nominee for governor in New York State. You had this story out of New York City. 16-year-old boy who allegedly punched a cop in Manhattan subway station was free to strike after being sprung without bail in a violent robbery just a few days earlier. He and three others jumped a 49-year-old man at a midtown street, punching the victim, running off with his cell phone. And then he's out, and then he gets in a row with a cop and punches a cop in the subway station. And the implications, right? This is sort of what we're talking about with this green energy stuff. The left doesn't like the implications, the consequences of the policies they pursue. Whether it's the inflationary result of some of the energy policies that they have pursued, or it is the lawlessness with respect to no cash bail and the anti-police movement, the policies to mollify the anti-police movement in places like New York City and state.
Well, I guess they. You say the left doesn't like the consequences of their policy.
Well, Eric Adams seems to not appreciate the consequences of some of the policies that he and others on the left have pursued, because they spend a lot of time hand wringing when the consequences are obviously negative, general violence and lawlessness, for example.
Yeah, and Eric Adams, I think, is a bona fide moderate. In at least some respects, and is a former cop himself. But I always come back to all of the progressive cities, and I'm in one, which is New York, and you're in one, which is Chicago, and all around the country, all of the major cities are run by the left wing, and the farther and the deeper they get into it, the higher the percentage of the vote they get in the elections, and they never get voted out, not even close. The only election that counts in New York City is the Democratic primary, which is completely dominated by the most progressive faction of the party.
But to your point, and it was perceived when it happened that Eric Adams got out of that primary and became the mayor, sort of a refutation of the de Blasio years, some argued.
No, I would agree with you on that. On the other hand, the city council races and the state legislative races in New York have moved, in the recent elections, have moved more and more to the left. More and more of the allies of AOC are getting themselves into the state legislature and in the city council. Now, in this next round, in 2022, the city council is not up, but the legislature is, and the Congress is, and that may move back some in New York. I think Zeldin actually has a chance in New York State.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Right, Kathy Hochul, the governor who took over from lieutenant governor after Cuomo resigned, is a real non-entity and just doesn't know what she's doing. And Zeldin is a very good guy. So it is actually possible that a Republican could win the New York State governorship, as does occur in Illinois with the governor from time to time also.
Do you think that the incident last week where Zeldin was attacked, do you think that is a watershed moment in New York? How is that being received?
You know, it got some big coverage in the New York Post, but I don't know that it's been it's not making that many waves. And to be honest about it, first of all, it wasn't in New York City. It was in Rochester, which is, yeah, you know, a long ways off.
Yeah.
Second, the guy was, I mean, he had a very half-baked excuse for a weapon, which was some kind of a sharp-edged keychain made out of plastic. I don't know if it would have been an effective weapon or not if he actually had got to Zeldin. But the other thing is the guy was, like, drunk. He was staggering around, could hardly stand up. It was a very bizarre event, and I don't know that any and that guy was not somebody who was like a violent criminal who'd just been released without bail or something. He was a one-off crazy.
No, he was.
Yeah, but after he did it,
he was released. Yeah, he was released subsequently, and then the feds had to pick him up.
Correct. After the event, he was released without bail immediately.
Wasn't there any outrage then when he was released?
Well, certainly the New York Post made of it what they could. I also read the New York Times. I don't read it quite as religiously. I mean, I think they basically buried the story. They didn't care much about
it.
Well,
right. I the question is, I mean, we understand how the different outlets will cover something like that.
Yeah.
The question, though, is just sort of more generally what's happening in New York, which is, you know, something akin to what's happening in Chicago, though it's much worse here.
It is much worse in Chicago.
Yeah. We know that the data speaks to that. It's been that way for a while, with Chicago having more murders than New York and L.A. combined. That alone tells you about all you need to know. But is there, and Adam seems to be trying to speak to this. He's complaining about being overrun by illegal immigrants and putting pressure on the city's public welfare resources. Maybe you shouldn't be a sanctuary city and a sanctuary state, but of course he doesn't want to touch that. And he's also talked a good deal about crime with some high profile violent crime incidents. And I just wonder if you think that's really resonating. Is that motivating? Is it getting people, including in Manhattan, who are left, to think a second time and thus, you know, potentially put a marker down by helping Lee Zeldin stage a surprise upset?
The Manhattan lefty is not going to vote for Lee Zeldin. I hate to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, go back to Giuliani when it got bad enough in the 80s and early 90s. The New York voter made Giuliani mayor, and after him Bloomberg, and that brought the crime rate. And I use the murder rate as kind of my index for the crime, for the overall crime rate. But the murder rate in New York in about 1992, when Giuliani was elected, was 26 per 100,000. That's approximately the same as Chicago's today.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went all the way down to four per 100,000. So the number of murders went down from 2,200 a year to about under 400 a year. That was the change. It was a huge change. Well, now it's back to about 700 a year, 600 to 700 a year. So, you know, we're still more than four times safer than Chicago, but only half as safe as we were a very few short years ago.
Yeah. I get it. It's the question of is it, you know, has it gotten bad enough yet? And I guess that's the question that a lot of cities are going to answer at the ballot box on November 8th.
Dan, in where I live in Greenwich Village in Manhattan, you don't notice crime particularly. There actually was a murder in Greenwich Village within the past month or so. A homeless guy who was down at the river in the park was murdered by somebody. I don't know if they've caught the perpetrator, but I mean, and you know, it was a middle of the night murder of a homeless guy in a park by the river, which is very much at the border of the neighborhood. But you don't notice crime in the neighborhood. The stores around where I am, I think there's some shoplifting in the drug stores, but it's not in your face. It's not at all in your face. Yeah. And I'm a regular rider of the subway. It's not in your face in the subway either.
I loved nice. I loved Richard Arlen in Murder in Greenwich Village. Francis Benton, the Manhattan Contrarian, ManhattanContrarian.com. Francis, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Cassidy Hutchinson, star witness at the J6 Star Chamber proceeding.
Oh, yeah. We talked about her a little yesterday.
Cassidy Hutchinson, the star witness, courageous young woman coming forward, embracing Liz Cheney. Physically embracing Liz Cheney at the hearing.
They hugged, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yet we know from reporting by Molly Hemingway and Tristan Justice at The Federalist that that's a very different Cassidy Hutchinson than she was for the entire run-up to her testimony, just about. In a series of private communications from December 20 through May 2021, Hutchinson through the spring of last year. Hutchinson commiserated with other targets of the probe about how little information she had about any wrongdoing that day and lamented how corrupt the politicized committee was. Far from being upset with Trump, she repeatedly spoke in favor of him and his presidency. So that's 5 months after January 6th.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather shoot myself dead into the Potomac than see Marine One flying around the city without 45 again. Referring to Trump.
Then who got to her?
6 days after she was issued a subpoena, she called the Jan 6 panel a, quote, phony committee, unquote. She also said she had nothing to offer. Quote, other than a handful of irrelevant texts, I have literally no documents or anything they're asked about. They're asking about. Of Benny Thompson and her being subpoenaed in November, we were effed by Benny Thompson, the chair of the committee. She joked he would be sending her to jail and hoped that another friend would come visit her. She called the panel's probe BS, according to a text published by the Daily Caller earlier this month. Hutchinson praised the tweet calling into question the legitimacy of the committee. When we win again, we're making her comms director or press secretary, referring to someone questioning the outcome of the election. She used the phrase "stop the steal" to describe efforts to contest the 2020 election. On January 5th, tweet notes that she stopped by the Capitol where Trump supporters had gathered, quote, "gotta see our people," unquote. That's very different than how she testified before the Star Chamber about being disgusted with the riot, isn't it? In November 21, she joked about trying to invade a friend's apartment in a building called Park Chelsea. Let's have an insurrection at Park Chelsea. How about January 6, 2023? It just goes on and on.
And then she got up there in prime time, might you remember that, and said, you know, hearsay, that Trump grabbed the wheel of the limousine to try to turn, you know, the car to the Capitol instead of going back to the White House. It logistically, if you're in a limousine, you're really going to, you're so far away from the driver, you physically cannot get there and try and grab the wheel. And that was all a lie. Anyway.
It was disputed by Secret Service, at least.
Right. And they were there.
In May,
she wasn't there. She just repeated hearsay.
In May, she outlined a conversation she had with a stranger in D.C., a real conversation that just took place. Person on sidewalk, your sweatshirt says 45. Me, yes. Person, like Trump. Person stares. Me, I'm an insurrectionist. And then I put my headphones in. The end. She had previously been critical of Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, calling them a crop of losers. She marked their self-conception as, quote, the Republican martyrs, unquote. She said of Liz Cheney vis-a-vis Trump, even if Trump were to fall off the face of the earth, her neocon policies are not where the base's ideological politics currently are, nor will head. And apparently all of what she believed through the at least the spring of 2021 changed when Barbara Comstock, as a former Virginia rep and never Trumper, and Alyssa Farah Griffin, who's a former Trump staffer, who's been named to the Meghan McCain seat on The View for her willingness to denounce conservatives and Trump and criticize those who would question the 2020 election results and so forth, where they stepped in and came up with a way to pay her legal bills. And this Alyssa Farah Griffin has taken credit for changing Cassidy Hutchinson's mind and thus her testimony.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, and then a quick comment. And now we're learning this morning, she's going to be helping the Department of Justice with their probe into this.
Some help she's going to provide.
Yeah, they better really investigate her because they're going to find out that she's a liar.
There's also this, and this isn't getting near enough attention. We mentioned it earlier in the week. I want to mention it again. This is good reporting by John Salma. We talked about it with Carafano on Monday. This memo memorializing a January 3rd meeting with Trump, General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's been held over. You know, he's part of the Biden administration, chairman, still chairman. And his then acting defense secretary, Christopher Miller. January 3rd, 3 days before January 6th. Quote, Mr. Miller and Jen Milley met with President at the White House at 5:30 p.m. The primary topic they discussed was unrelated to the scheduled rally. General Milley told us that at the end of the meeting, the president told Mr. Miller there would be a large number of protesters on January 6th, and Mr. Miller should ensure sufficient National Guard or soldiers would be there to make sure it was a safe event. General Milley told us that. Mr. Miller responded, we've got a plan and we've got it covered. This is the Pentagon IG memorializing what they were told by Milley. Milley, Christopher Miller, acting SecDef, and Trump, 3 days before, Trump saying, going to have a large number of protesters, make sure it's safe. His acting Secretary of Defense, we've got a plan and we've got it covered. This is a coup d'etat. This is the orchestrator of a coup d'etat. This is an armed orchestrator of an armed insurrection or an insurrection generally, since there weren't really any arms. What the hell? It's just unbelievable.
It's unbelievable they can get away with it, and it's unbelievable that the media is in on it and giving them prime time access.
Speaking of which, now John Daniel Davidson, also over at The Federalist, we got the news this week that the FBI falsely labeled verified intelligence and credible evidence against Hunter Biden as disinformation in order to shut down an investigation of him in the run-up to the 2020 presidential election. Uh-huh. This from a letter that was released by Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, addressed to Merrick Garland and Christopher Wray. Numerous high credible whistleblowers have come forward about a scheme in place among certain FBI officials to undermine derogatory information connected to Hunter Biden by falsely suggesting it was disinformation. How many elections does the FBI get to meddle in before we start to call the FBI in for review and questioning? Or start to have a real serious debate about whether the FBI continued to exist in its current form? They meddled in the 2016 election. Now we find that they
meddled in the 2020
election. I mean, they were part and parcel of trying to sideline Trump's policy agenda and Republicans' policy agenda during his presidency with the pursuit of this Russian hoax. Please see Jim Comey, Andrew McCabe et al. And we're supposed to stay singly focused on Jan 6th. And we have voicemails now from Hunter's laptop, which has been authenticated by the New York Times.
Oh, I can't wait. People have got to hear this.
This is good.
Everything
that Biden has been saying, both Bidens have been saying, both Hunter and the big guy, of course is a lie. Of course it's a lie. Oh, I had no idea what he was doing. No, don't believe Tony Bobulinski, who is, you know, cut in on the, well, brought in to be the CEO of this China energy venture that they started. No, if I don't believe him. Don't believe Hunter's own words, cut the big guy in for 10%. How about this voicemail that the big guy left for Hunter?
Hey, pal, it's Dad. It's 8:15. On Wednesday night, if you get a chance, give me a call. Nothing urgent. Just want to talk to you. I thought the article, at least the thing on online, it's going to be printed tomorrow in the Times, was good. I think it's clear. And anyway, if you get a chance, give me a call. I love you.
Love you, too. This is congratulating Hunter for surviving a New York Times story about the dealings, his dealings with a disgraced Chinese mogul. Was good. I think you're clear. I think you're clear. What?
Oh my God.
I mean, honestly.
Oh, this is bad.
Star Chamber proceedings on the one hand that are completely violative of due process norms, any sense of fair play.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
And on the other hand, as Holman Jenkins writes, adjust your picture of press corruption. It's not so much the lies they tell as the truths they withhold or suppress. Not just big tech rallying to the defense to suppress the New York Post story on Hunter Biden prior to the 2020 election. But the FBI, some people at the FBI apparently running interference against other people at the FBI that were investigating Hunter Biden. And the only hope we have,
too.
The only hope we have for justice, well, this is a sick comment. The only hope we have for justice when it comes to this crime family from Delaware is if Joe Biden doesn't take the stairs when his party tells him to take the stairs. If they have to defenestrate him, that's when the stories come out about Joe Biden lied and Hunter and going all the way back to ousting that Ukrainian prosecutor for Hunter's benefit. That's when we'll get the stories that we know about Joe and Hunter and the family business dealings memorialized by Peter Schweitzer in his book and detailed every step of the way by the New York Post and other outlets based on the information from Hunter's authenticated laptop. That's when the stories come. But the only way is if Joe Biden doesn't step aside when the left tells him to step aside. What a sad commentary that is on the Department of Justice, on the FBI, on where we are. Frank in Arlington Heights.
I never knew no godfather. I had my own family, Senator. I don't know this man. I was in the olive oil business with his father, but that was a long, long time ago, Senator. Oh, I know what you're talking about. I was in a meeting with the FBI guys, and they said, Michael Corleone, he did this, and Michael Corleone did that. So I said, yeah! But that's all a lie, Senator.
That is,
of course, is Frank
wonderful. Wonderful. Very, very good. How long did it take you to
Cassidy?
How long did it take
you to see Cassidy Hutchinson to do that at some point when the Republicans take Congress and have her? So
how long did it take you to perfect Frank Pangangeli?
Oh, well, you know, I've seen that movie so many times, so I've, you know, I'm always practicing my voices. But, you know, when you kind of mentioned her this morning, I'm like, this is a good time to do that one.
Yeah,
so,
that's very good. You know how many times times Amy has seen The Godfather?
Zero?
Yeah.
Or is it
double goose eggs?
Yeah, zero. She doesn't even she doesn't even appreciate the greatness of that impersonation. Frank.
No, well, I've maybe seen clips. So I get what you were doing, but I just
you need
the
context.
The offer.
You need the context to fully appreciate it.
Okay.
Maybe this will inspire her to go see all three of them, although the third one is pretty bad.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Just the first two.
Have a great week.
Very good.
Take care.
Very good, Frank. Thank you for that contribution.
I love Frank. Really
listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. It was just a month ago where the Supreme Court of the United States struck down the concealed carry law in the state of New York that required a person who wanted to carry a concealed handgun outside the home to show, quote unquote, proper cause for the license to do so. That was the decision in the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin case. And you remember the governor, Kathy Hochul, had this to say on the occasion of that Supreme Court announcement.
As governor of the state of New York, my number one priority is to keep New Yorkers safe. But today, the Supreme Court is sending us backwards in our efforts to protect families and prevent gun violence. And it's particularly painful that this came down at this moment, when we're still dealing with families in pain from mass shootings that have occurred, the loss of life, their beloved children and grandchildren. Today, the Supreme Court struck down a New York law that limits who can carry concealed weapons. Does everyone understand what a concealed weapon means? That you have no forewarning, that someone can hide a weapon on them and go into our subways, go into our grocery stores like stores up in Buffalo, New York, where I'm from, go into a school in Parkland or Uvalde. This could place millions of New Yorkers in harm's way. And this is at a time when we're still mourning the loss of lives, as I just mentioned. This decision isn't just reckless, it's reprehensible. It's not what New Yorkers want. And we should have the right of determination of what we want to do in terms of our gun laws in our state.
Yeah, well, it turns out that New York residents are also still American citizens entitled to the protections enshrined in the Constitution. I know that's offensive to Governor Hochul, but that's the truth.
Yeah, and concealed carry has nothing to do with the Uvalde shooting or with the supermarket shooting in Buffalo. What is she talking about?
Well, the other thing, too, is, and this is also the myopia of the political hack. You act like the concealed carry is some sort of evil novelty. Thing. Like, this is something that hasn't been the law in a majority of states for generations. I mean, Florida started with concealed carry in the late 80s. And this dystopian future that gun banners like Kathy Hochul paint that will be brought about by the right to carry, individual citizens having the right to carry, just never materialized. What actually has materialized in big blue city America, you have a dystopian present. under the stewardship of politicians like Kathy Hochul. But just because the Supreme Court invalidated that law doesn't mean the gun confiscators in New York State, starting with the governor, are done. Of course, they will fight every step of the way to be as restrictive as they can be. And that brings us to our next guest. Zvi Waldman is the founder of the New York State Jewish Gun Club, and he is moving on state government there for restrictions to the right to carry in New York, despite what the Supreme Court handed down at the end of last month. Zvi, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yes, hi.
So where do things stand now with the Supreme Court decision and the posture of Kathy Hochul and New York Democrats?
So I think the first thing, if the governor is really, you know, wants to keep us safe, how about she actually enacts the no cash bail law that she passed, that we have literally criminals that get arrested for repeated offense and they literally walk out the next day? I think that would be a good start if she really cares to keep us safe. This is obviously a knee rejection reaction from the left when they see that they lost and they know there's no way out of it. So this is like them grandstanding, and it's for pure political posture. And the fact they're doing all this political theater on the backs of people is disgusting.
And concealed carry is something good. I mean, look at what happened in Indianapolis. You know, at the shopping mall there, the guy, the good guy, had a gun, and he took down the offender with, you know, 8 shots in a matter of 15 seconds. But they
definitely
seem to be
ignoring it. The quickest way to stop a bad guy is somebody else that's there on the spot, that within a couple of seconds they can react and end it.
Well, and so where are things now? I mean, are there still prohibitions on guns in public places of accommodation, like places of worship?
So right now the law doesn't go into effect until September. So right now we're still on the old laws. And there are a couple of lawsuits that are in the court system, and it looks pretty good. The judge hinted that he wants to give the ruling before the law goes into effect. So, you know, fingers crossed. But the other strange thing, the signs that we put up in all the stores are only valid for stores, a synagogue, a church, a school, medical facilities, a whole bunch of other places. You are not allowed to carry no matter what. And that's really, really disturbing.
Well, so that's really interesting because on the one hand, you heard Kathy Hochul say New York should have self-determination when it comes to gun rights. On the other hand, she doesn't want, like, for example, the congregants at a synagogue to have self-determination with respect to their private house of worship.
Correct. That's really, to be so blazoned. I know, like, from speaking with legislators, there were a lot of people trying to carve out exemption for synagogue and churches, and she adamantly did not want to do that. So the question is the motive behind it, and it's really, really disturbing.
Well, why didn't she want to do that?
I think the only conclusion I can have is she wants to have the monopoly of power, and that scares me.
Yeah, and I mean, and speaking of things in the news, since she brought up Buffalo in her remarks about the Supreme Court decision, the Highland Park shooting here in the suburbs, we had this incident. The shooter who was responsible for all those deaths on July 4th had gone to a synagogue prior to the shooting and had been chased out of the synagogue by the rabbi there, as well as by security, because they clearly understood he was not a member of the congregation. But I mean, this is one of the reasons why there's a desire to have security at houses of worship, particularly, right. And frankly, particularly in New York, with the incidents of anti-Semitism and Jews being targeted, makes even more sense.
Correct. And there's a different point I want to pick. I want to point out, as you mentioned, he was chased out by the rabbi. Right now, if you would hire a third-party security company, even if you would hire a retired cop, there's no way they understand the nuances of the community and they understand who belongs there, who not. No one is more suited to take on this role as somebody from the community, somebody from the synagogue, from the church that knows everybody and could identify these people that don't belong there easily.
So they're telling you to hire security if you don't feel safe at your synagogue?
That's our only option, and it's costly. And second of all, like as the Supreme Court ruled, it's a constitutional right. Like there's no need to outsource security to the government.
Yeah, that's right. Clarence Thomas was pretty clear in the majority opinion that the right to protect yourself exists outside the home because that's just eminently logical. And so what sort of a coalition is coming together, particularly in light of the spike in violence, as you mentioned, the no cash bail law and the you know, turnstile justice there in New York like we have in Chicago? Do you see business people in addition to clergy and other groups being represented in this push for the full complement of your individual rights in New York?
So as the government like pushes back harder, more and more people get upset, and people that were never vocal are vocal now. From talking to people in the community, going around to shops, handing out signs, I see a lot of people that were reserved to be vocal now are so upset that they're actually being vocal about it now. So there is way more pushback, and I think because it's clearly anybody with any logic looks at this and says this is ridiculous.
And the response from we talked a little bit about this earlier in the program with the Manhattan Contrarian. What's your sense of the response on this issue of self-protection in light of the attack on Lee Zeldin last week?
It just shows the irony of this whole situation. You know, and from the response that I'm getting from the public is people are actually upset that now they need to be vocal because a lot of people just want to mind their own business and they want to, you know, carry and do the right thing. And they don't want to necessarily let people know they have a gun because they understand there's still a lot of people from the other side of the political spectrum that don't want it and they don't want to offend them. Like, we don't want to be in your face with guns. We want to just be safe and mind our own business. Now they're kind of forced to put up a sign, CCW welcome here. They have to almost put up their political identity. And it's disgusting, like as if the country is not divided enough and there's not enough going on in the culture war, you're just forcing us to pick a side and to be vocal about it.
But sometimes you have to pick a side. I mean, are you guys willing to vote for a Republican governor?
Oh,
it starts at the top.
100%. Look, people in my community and, you know, we always support the Republican and conservative agenda simply because it aligns more with like Judaism and our beliefs and that down the line. So yeah, I think all of this is just going to get more people to realize how ridiculous the progressive agenda is.
Yeah. Clearly the Orthodox Jewish community, not the problem in New York City. The other thing I wanted to get your sense in terms of impact, Jose Alba, the bodega clerk or Bogota clerk, as Jill Biden says, and that self-defense case and ultimately the charges being dropped only because of public pressure on Alvin Bragg. But how much is like a self-defense case like that? I mean, it speaks to the same issue. And I just wonder what you saw as the reverberations from that case when the bodega owners got together and were defending him and were calling on the charges to be dropped. And then you're getting, again, more coalition partners when it comes to people being able to provide for their own protection, like the Latino community.
Right. So, yeah, it's the same thing. The more of these stories that happen, the more you clearly see what the agenda is and who they really care for. And I think this is part of the overall problem that like the politicians in Albany and in big government are just too far attached from the people on the street, from, you know, people just want to live their lives and be safe and that's it. And they don't need government to intro and try to fix everything with another law, with another legislation. I think government needs to like take a step back and like really listen to what people are interested in saying and not just pandering to a woke ideology.
He is V. Waldman, founder of New York State Jewish Gun Clubs. V, thanks for joining us and good luck out there. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Have a wonderful
day. Thank you. Yeah, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
So would you have made the Victor Bout, Brittany Griner trade?
Yeah. I don't know. Well, you get Whelan too, so that's
Yeah, you get a two-for-one deal. And I think you get a fourth-round draft pick in the 20.
Here's the thing. She better stand up for the national anthem. No. No more kneeling. No more sitting down if they make this trade.
If she even wants to
show
come back.
Show a little respect.
She even wants to come back, according to LeBron. Victor Bout, you know, that's who was the character in Nick Cage's Lord of War was based on.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm thinking I would have offered up Mikhail Brishnikov. We'll return him, and we get Griner back. Brishnikov, I mean, you know, I think they're still smarting from White Knights. And Brishnikov and Gregory Hines and defecting. And so, I mean, he's 75 years old. Return Brishnikov. We get Griner. He's lived a life in the U.S. He's done Sex in the City.
I was just going to say that. Yeah. Jessica Parker's boyfriend in a few episodes. So, he's lived a good life, life.
He's had a good run. He can do a little Solzhenitsyn time over in Russia. Well, and we get Brittany Griner back so that Mike's got somebody to watch in the WNBA.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.